Access number 30416, Mr. John Taylor, Rail 8. Now, we're talking about the rail on Melle-les-Combes on the 3rd of May 1944 by 50 Squadron. And you talked about, you could generally, you got off onto a bit about the wireless, yes, broadcast, the dance broadcast, but what about you? What happened that night? You could hear on the intercom people getting more and more desperate, I think you said.
Yes, I mean, usually you're over the target for as short a time as possible. It felt very, very uncomfortable going round and round for 12, 15 minutes or so. In fact, I think it probably went as long as half an hour. And, of course, the gunners were crying out, "There's another one gone! There's a lank down, and another lank down." Actually, I think about 43... was shot down at that time. And I think we lost about 6. And when you think there are 7 crew members in each one that's shot down, there's a lot of empty spaces. And Butch, for all his bullions, was particularly affected by this.
Now, how did you get out of that? Sorry, before we come to the effects on your friend. How did you actually get away from it? I mean, did you drop your bombs? How did the raid resolve?
Well, eventually the signal came through. And belatedly, we all dashed in then and dropped the bombs. I think the gunners were firing even as we were on our bombing run, firing at fighters. But Jack still did his straight and level until the flash went off, because he was determined we would get aiming point pictures.
Can you explain that? Because we missed that out the first time. What are these? Because you didn't drop them last time.
No.
What are these photographs, aiming point pictures?
Well, you had a camera fitted underneath, or at least so it could take pictures below, directly below the aircraft, with an open lens, so that it was light. It could only take pictures when it was light enough to take them. And you had a flash that was synchronized with dropping your bombs that went off at the moment when the bombs hit the ground. And then that flashed, lit up the whole scene, and you took a picture of where your bombs had landed, and that was your aiming point picture. And I don't know, we got the idea that if you didn't get near enough your aiming point, it wouldn't count as a trip, although it was never officially said to us. But anyway, that was a trip that really unnerved Butch.
Now, Butch, what was his surname again? Sorry.
Clem Dowie. Clem Dowie.
He was a cheery Australian.
Yes, that's a cheery Australian.
Now, what effect did the casualties in the squadron have on you and him then?
Well, he got more and more uptight. More and more uptight. And
as rear gunner, he'd seen...
He'd seen everything, you see. He'd got grandstand view of the whole lot.
Now, how did he show his upset? His I mean, was it a matter of nerves, or was it that he was going bonkers?
Chattering excitedly, and movements, little twitches and things.
More than usual?
More than usual, yes.
And did the doctors notice this?
Well, Jack stood him down for one trip. And then, of course, the next trip was even worse. From our point of view, because it was to Brest.
Now, that's the 8th of May. Now, before that, you'd named your aircraft, and the name you chose may or may not have been significant. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, because it was a V, and actually our aircraft, of course, it wasn't new to us, and every time we went on a trip, the ground crew painted a bomb onto the side of the fuselage, and it had already done 50, 60 trips. So it was a veteran before we took it. And we said, what should we call it? And me being the literary one, they seemed to turn to me. I said, well, not Vengeance. And so they painted Vengeance along there. And then I had an uneasy feeling. Kept thinking of the saying, vengeance is mine, said the Lord. I think, what if he wants us? But he didn't at that time. But
so you went on a trip without Butch, and yes, that was to, on the 6th of May, and nothing much happened.
Nothing
you
much.
You noticed that there's no detail in your logbook about that either. It's to Luales, but nothing happened.
Yes.
Now tell me about the 8th of May, you attacked the submarine pens at Brest.
Yes.
What do you remember of that?
Well, first of all, there was intense ACAC fire because of the importance of the harbour. I'm not even sure there wasn't a battleship in the harbour at the time.
Now, what was it like? I mean, you've mentioned flak, but what was intense flak like? I mean, before it was just flak, but not like this.
Well, if you looked at it, it seemed to fill the sky in front of you, and you thought, crikey, how can anybody fly through that and not get hit? And you'd got the searchlights, of course, all probing the sky. And they'd got a big blue searchlight that seemed to be a master searchlight. And if that got you, somehow it communicated with the other searchlights and they instantly coned in on you. And they called it coning. You were coned. And we were coned.
Now, what's it like being coned? What's it like inside the aircraft?
Absolutely brighter than the brightest summer day you can imagine, with all these searchlights on you. It's incredible. And then, of course, your heart sinks because you know that all the flak's going to be directed on you as well, because the searchlights have got you and they've got your position and everything. You're all lit up like Rock's Benefit.
Now, what did your pilot do?
Well, immediately put it into the steepest dive he could.
So he didn't corkscrew, which is what they were meant
to do? No. He didn't corkscrew. He dived. Because, you see, the sea was underneath us. And Norman helped him. Because we dived down to 200 feet. And at 200 feet, I could see, because I was looking, Jack and Butch and Norman pulling back on each on the steering columns, and we levelled out.
So how close were? I mean, you seem to have nearly flown into the sea.
Yes, we did. We did nearly. I mean, 200 feet at the speed we were diving at is nearly flying into the sea. And then he went down even lower. And he skimmed the water all the way back to the coast.
Now, as you were diving, you could hear Butch was your rear gunner was upset. Now,
yes.
Can you explain what was happening?
He was screaming and he was saying, "Let's get out of here, Jack," and "Oh, we're going to die," and you know, things like that. And
he hadn't done that before.
No. The rear gunner said, "If you don't shut up, Butch..."
So the mid-upper gunner said.
The mid-upper gunner said, "I'm going to put a burst through your turret." And then he went quiet. We found out afterwards he pulled his intercom out, so we couldn't hear him. And he never flew again. When we got back, he was reported sick. And they sent him to a mental hospital at Matlock. And then they repatriated him to Australia.
Now, was he actually designated as lack of moral fibre, or was he just treated as a casualty? Because he had gone mad from the sound of it.
Treated as a casualty. I don't know, if it had been British, it would have probably been LMF. Because it always used to annoy me intensely. All these types that don't fly and get through the war fairly easily. We were volunteers and flying, and he could have done 12 ops and you could have got the aiming point every time, and then it got through to you, and finally, and that resolution that had held you had cracked. They branded you lack of moral fibre, stripped you down to aircraftman second class, and sent you to clean the latrines. And I thought that was terrible treatment for somebody who had actually done more than most to help the country.
So you had sympathy for Dowie, for Bush.
Great sympathy for him. Yeah.
Did you ever see what? I mean, did you ever find out what happened to him back when he got back to Australia? I mean, did he recover? Because some of them do recover.
Yeah, he did recover because he Jack told me that he'd got in touch with him some years after the war with a scheme to go plantation owning, because he'd worked on a plantation in New Guinea before the war. But Jack wasn't having any of it. He was very shrewd. He was a farm factor.
Apparently he'd had lots of bad news, Dowie.
Yes.
Yes. But you didn't know that at the time.
Didn't know that at the time,
did
no.
Did you find that out later? Well, because that may have impacted on his going to pieces.
I'm sure it did. We didn't know until Jack, being a New Zealander, was in touch with him in Australia.
So what was this bad news?
I think his mother had died. His wife wanted to divorce him. And he was always boasting about what a beautiful wife he'd got and everything. So he'd got a lot on his plate.
His brother was killed as well, I think.
Yes, yes.
So that probably all...
all helped. It must do.
Now, about this time, obviously, you got a new gunner. This would be Doug Gap.
Doug Gap.
Now, a sergeant, I presume, most gunners are.
No, he was a warrant officer.
Right. Now, what was he like?
Quiet. Very friendly. He was a Canadian. He fitted in well with the crew once we got to know him. He used to come out with us. The sad thing about Doug, of course, was that he came after we'd already done 5 or 6 ops. And so when we finished, he'd still got those to do. They didn't finish him at the same time. They posted him to another crew. And he went west on the very next trip. And I've always thought, should we have done 5 more just to... finish at the same time, but no.
Now, at this stage, you seem to have gone on to some trips against railway, marshalling yards, railway junctions.
Yes.
You know, in France and prior to the D-Day, because we're in May now. I mean, you know,
yes.
We're moving in quite deep into May.
We were.
Now, what were these raids like? I know you don't remember them individually.
No.
We can't go through all 30 ops or so.
No, we can't.
Because you just wouldn't remember them. And there's too many the same.
Basically, we were trying to disrupt the whole German rail communication system before D-Day, so they couldn't move their troops about from one place to another easily. And so these marshalling yards were the vital junctions. They weren't easy trips because obviously they were vital to the Germans as well, so they were heavily defended, and we hadn't got air superiority fighters at that time, so we still got a lot of night fighters to contend with. There was one of these trips particular I remember, though, because when the command bombs gun came, I think the engineer or whoever opens the bomb doors, said, hang on, the bomb doors aren't open. So they push the button to open the bomb doors, and the agonizing 2 seconds before the contacts were made and the bombs dropped. So they overshot our target, and they dropped in sidings way beyond. And there was the most tremendous explosion. The whole sky lit up and debris flying into the air, according to the rear gunner who was reporting it. And there'd been an ammunition train or 2 ammunition trains and a troop train and they'd halted them in the sidings, and our bombs had dropped on them. Well, this is what was told afterwards, after the reports came back from Europe.
That's probably one of the biggest successes you could ever wish. I mean, a lot of people killed.
A lot of people killed, yes.
But a huge success, nevertheless.
Yes.
And how did you know, how did you find out about that? Or was it just intelligence?
Intelligence reports came back from Europe, and then it made its way to the squadron, and Jack was told, and of course he told us. But these raids went on, and I don't think at that time we had any.
There's two things here that are interesting. Is that you get things to try and put off to sort of reduce the danger from night fighters. I wonder if you'd tell us about that. One is a microphone instead of the engines.
Yes.
I didn't understand that at all. Can you just explain that for us?
Yes, well, you can imagine that the people who were monitoring all the air waves to find out what we were talking about and everything, they're all sitting there with their phones clamped on. So I had a microphone inside the engine bay.
Now, why there? Why not in the aeroplane?
Because it was noisier in the engine itself. I mean, noisy enough in the aeroplane. You couldn't talk to each other normally. You had to either talk over the intercom or go right up to whoever you're talking to and pull their air flap up and shout into their ear. It was so noisy. In fact, there is a disease called Lancaster ear. So many people reported going deaf after.
So what was this? But wasn't it even noisier in the engine?
It was even noisier, and that's the idea. Because it broadcast the engine noise into the earphones of all these Germans who were listening. And they couldn't hear. It either deafened them or stopped them listening to what we were talking about.
So it was simply a deafening plan?
Yes.
And what was the other?
And the other was what they called window, which were bundles of tin foil. And by throwing those out of the aircraft down the flare chute, you could they'd spread and a whole lot of reflections from this fluttering tin foil as it came down. And it obscured the German radar. Instead of being able to pick out where the bombers were sending reflections back, you got all this reflection right across. It was like jamming there, same as G was jammed. It was jamming there. The other thing at that time that introduced was the idea of certain navigators sending back their winds that they'd found, and then they averaged the winds and they broadcast that to the whole bomber force, and we all had to fly using those winds whether we agreed with them or not.
Now, was that good or bad?
Well, it had the effect of keeping the bombers in a tight formation, because it was the bomber that strayed outside the stream that got picked off by the night fighters, because, you know, it showed up. It's like when a hawk attacks a cloud of pigeons. It's the one right on the outside that gets attacked. The rest are confused by the mass. And so that was a good thing. It kept them all together.
So whether it was right or wrong, in a sense it was better, because it meant you all flew together.
Yes.
And
yes.
You were all making slightly the wrong mistake or whatever.
Yes, yes. And it corrected itself as you neared the target, because the pathfinders would be sending back information. So it made my job easier in a way, that I wasn't having to find my own winds. I was only having to apply them and give the pilot the course and everything.
Now, another thing is you have trouble when you came back and had to be diverted. That's on a trip to Tours on the 19th of May. But you were diverted
to Benson.
What do you remember about that?
Well, the thing about that, of course, we'd been on a long trip, 6 hours 35, and we got to this, and it was a training airfield. They weren't used to handling bombers. You see, a bomber airfield, they could take off at 2 minute intervals. One would be taking off, one would be in the middle of the runway, while the other one was just turning on. And the same with landing. One would be turning off at the end of the runway, one would be halfway just touching down, and the other one would be in the final approach. Now, at Benson, what they did was stack us up and made a circuit and called us down one by one. And of course, we were short of fuel. And you got voices saying, F's sake, get it. There's a downer, no petrol left. And somebody else said, coming down, like it or not. And we did see one crash. And we were flying over the burning wreckage, still circling over the burning wreckage. But we got down eventually, but it showed us the difference between the efficiency of a bomber station and training station.
Now, another time, you had to go to Scotland when there's sort of fog everywhere over England.
Yes.
Now, what happened there? Yeah, pretty close escape.
Yes. The fog had closed right down over the whole of Lincolnshire and Yorkshire, and we were diverted to Scotland. I don't know the name of the aircraft, forget it, but I don't know whether I even put it in.
Doesn't say in your notes. So.
No, so probably I didn't put it in. But when we got there, our chart showed that there were hills on either side of the airfield. And so it was imperative that we didn't come down on top of one of the hills. I hadn't got a G chart. Or at least I can't remember.
I think in your notes you say that the pilot said you hadn't got a G-chart, yes, but you thought you had.
Yes. Because my recollection is that I was taking fixes and trying to give him tight turns where I thought was the exact midpoint between the two hills. And as we came down, we broke cloud only a few hundred feet above the airfield and landed safely. So that was hairy. And then, of course, being diverted, you're always in your flying kit. You hadn't got your shaving tackle or anything like that. And so then you had to wait till the next day and the aircraft refueled before you fly back. Made a very long trip of it.
Now, how cold was it in the aircraft? I hadn't asked you about the environment. We talked about the noise in the aircraft. What about the cold?
Well, there's supposed to be heating in the aircraft from where the heat from the engine was carried along a pipe that came back somewhere in the middle of the between me and the wireless op. It didn't always work. It could work too well and you got absolutely roasted. But most of the time it didn't work. And I remember it got so cold that, of course, you had to keep your silk gloves on. You took your gauntlets off because you couldn't do navigation with a pencil and dividers. I got used to working with silk gloves on. But the condensation from your hot breath on the inside of your oxygen mask dripped onto your chart, and as it hit the chart, it froze into little drops of ice. Got little drops of ice on the chart. It was as cold as that. And of course, the poor rear gunner with the centre panel removed from his, but he had an electrically heated suit. Nothing to do with my trips, but we got a bloke on aircrew, nicknamed Fingers, and he was a rear gunner, and he got a stoppage, and he, without thinking, he took his gloves off, his gauntlets off, to clear the stoppage, and his fingers all stuck to the gun, and he lost them all. He could still hold a pint pot though. Anyway,
the other thing is there's a problem outside with icing up with the wings. So tell me about that, because I've not heard much about that before. The wings icing up.
Yes, that was
the aircraft icing up.
One of the most dangerous things that could happen to you. And I told you about the Lancaster at Syston. Well, we were flying, and we're in cloud, and the mid-upper gunner reported he could see ice forming on the wings. And Jack said, well, we'll try and get above this. Couldn't go below because he knew it went almost down to the deck. And he climbed up and up, and still couldn't get rid of the icing. And then we came out between. There's layers of cloud above. But he got to go down again because we were too high at the time. So again we went down, and the ice again started to form. And he was jigging the aircraft to try and... I think we'd got some sort of device. I'm not sure about that, or whether I just read it, that's supposed to crack the ice. But we went down lower than we were destined to go, and luckily at that the ice melted at that height. We were able to continue into a clearer area, but that was very worrying because I could hear how the pilot and the engineer were worried, and so they worried, I worried.
Now at the back end of May you do a couple of raids on Duisburg and Brunsberg, and some Ruhr raids.
Yes.
Anything you remember about them? There's nothing in your notes. I'm surprised, because normally the Ruhr raids are quite bad. Do you not remember them too well?
Well, I remember them because there were lots of reports coming in of enemy fighters and flak. But by this time, you know, that was almost habitual. And unless I'd written it down in my logbook, that's the only way I can remember, when I hadn't done. But there were ball bearing factories we were bombing. They'd got this idea that if we could bomb the ball bearing factories, on which a lot of the German machinery depended, we could stop their factories producing. Don't think it ever did. It may have hampered it a bit,